Kennedy Drive.
Well, thank you for the invitation. I've been asked to say a little bit about immigration policy and raise some issues about potential implications for London. Now, before I get on to talking about policy, I just thought I'll say a few things that will be, I think, familiar to most people in the room, but still I think it's important to keep some basics about migration in London in mind when you start thinking about policy. Well, some obvious facts we've already heard about. What are the implications for London? Well, almost half of UK's migrants, foreign-born people, live in London. A third of the population in London is born abroad, of whom one-fourth are recent migrants. What's quite interesting, really, is I think in contrast to many other areas in the UK, London has a large number of new migrants, i.e. recently arrived, for example, from Poland. But of course, London also has some of the longest standing groups of settled migrants, people who came here a long time ago, were born abroad, many of whom will have acquired British citizenship in the meanwhile. So this is the complementary chart to the one that was presented by John on foreign-born in London. So in this case, India tops the group. Again, I won't go into this too much. Share of migrants in the population, obviously London again stands out. There's an interesting difference between inner and outer London. I'll get onto this in a minute. But I think it's important to appreciate the quite important interregional difference there. The shares of migrants in inner London are higher, but the growth, of course, in immigration has been much faster in some of the outer boroughs. And that has implications for things like housing and social housing debates because the pace of change was just much quicker. Now, some key features and issues. Of course, you've got very high population churn and mobility that has implications for the provision of public services. And we've seen that most debates around migration in London have actually focused around issues to do with public services, including social housing. You've got a very polarized labor market, including polarized migrant labor market. London has some of the richest and the poorest migrants in the country. As I said, there's big interregional differences. I think what's quite important to, again, keep in mind is that there's a very high reliance on migrants, particularly in low-wage sectors of the economy, such as contract cleaning and residential care. Care is probably the sector that I know best. About two-thirds of care assistants in London are thought to be foreign-born. Two-thirds of care assistants in London are foreign-born, and the trajectory is increasing, so that's important to keep in mind. We've already heard about estimates made by the LSE here about the stock of illegal resident migrants. What I just want to briefly talk about is the fact that London, from what we know from public opinion data, is significantly less opposed to immigration than other parts of the country. We last year, the Observatory ran an opinion poll with Ipsos Mori, basically trying to figure out how people think about specific groups of immigrants coming to the UK. We know that for about 30 years in this country, for about 30 years, two-thirds of the British public have been saying they want fewer migrants. So that's pretty constant, two-thirds. What we were trying to find out is, well, how do people feel about specific groups? And we were particularly interested in immigrants by purpose of entry. Now, these three groups, asylum seekers, extended family, and low-skilled workers, are the least popular ones among the categories that we polled on. And what's interesting here is that in almost all of these groups, London stands out as the area with the least opposition to these less popular groups. Now, it was a small sample size, just over 1,000 people, so not all of the differences are statistically significant, but London is different from other parts of the UK in terms of... So this measures the share of the public who say they want reduced immigration. London is the green bar on the left. So you see on asylum, on extended family, and on low-skilled workers, London stands out. The same applies to the more popular groups in the UK. So the most popular types of migrants are university students, followed by immediate family and high-skilled workers. Again, on most of these groups in London, people are in a way most supportive of immigration. Now, Now, this basic statement survives when you control for migrant status. So even if you look at white British nationals, you will get a difference in the data. You can get that mainly from the citizenship survey rather than from our data. Again, just the nationally, the interesting point, again, many of you will notice, but the interesting point that came out of this survey is that nationally, there's broad support for the overall goal of reducing immigration, two-thirds, but there's no majority support for reducing the specific categories that the government is currently reducing, and that's, of course, the dilemma. There is great support for reducing low-skilled immigration. Problem is, that's all from Eastern Europe now. There's great support for reducing asylum seekers. Problem is, they only constitute 4% of the total. And there's great support for reducing extended family members. The problem is that there's very few of them around because most family migration to this country is immediate family. There's no majority support for these groups. And the most interesting one is, of course, students, who by far make up the biggest group. And that's, of course, the dilemma for government. Now, moving on to policy. Now, of course, central government has no specific migration policy for London. That doesn't mean that there haven't been various initiatives by London mayors over time. I think it's fair to say that most of these initiatives have focused on integration issues. That is, of course, not surprising because the London mayor has no jurisdiction over controlling entry. So what do? If you cannot control admission, well, you see what you can do around integration policy. Maybe most notably in 2010, the mayor explicitly supported regularization, very much in contrast to national policy, and expressed his opposition to the cap. Now, in terms of policy, I thought it would be useful just to spend a couple of minutes going through some of the basics of what I think has happened over the years. So, crudely speaking, under the previous Labour government, I mean, the policy approach basically was, on labour immigration, was focused on selection with no numerical limits. Okay, so you try to attract the best of brightest, you come up with a points-based system, and you try to make the system quite rational. So it's a skills-based policy. Now, leaving aside whether or not the government succeeded in implementing that system, but that's what I think what they're trying to do. David Blunkett famously went on Newsnight saying that he does not see any obvious limit to migration. Now, that didn't play out so well with the public, because one thing we do know from public opinion polls, the public does not like migration to be unlimited or out of control. Hence, the current government's focus on having a strong narrative on numbers. So the focus with the new government has shifted from selection without an explicit policy on numbers to a focus on numbers. And within that, of course, you still select. So one way of reducing immigration is to become more selective. So that's why we have the net migration target. What's important to recognize about the net migration target is that it covers all types of migrants in the UK, including British and EU migrants. In practice, 95% of today's net migration is made up of non-EU nationals. 95% is made up of non-EU nationals. Why is that? Because the British net migration has long been negative, okay, so more Brits leaving than coming. Negative British net migration roughly offsets positive net migration from the wider EU. So if you add these two up, it's roughly around zero, which means that most net migration is non-EU national. Now, that's not the same thing as saying that that their net migration within Europe is zero, okay? I'm saying net migration of EU and British nationals is close to zero. But that includes EU and British nationals going anywhere in the world. There's a lot of British people obviously going to non-EU countries. But it's important to recognize that it focuses on non-EU. Now, if you want to reduce that from current 216 to less than 100,000, the primary way of doing that is to reduce non-EU immigration, because it's harder to do something on outflows. It's possible to do something on outflows. The government has changed settlement policy in order to boost emigration. Okay, you boost emigration, you reduce net migration, and that's why the government has made it more difficult to settle. Now, you reduce immigration, you focus on students, constitute 60% of inflows, workers 20%, family 20%. Another interesting aside is that we don't currently know net migration of students, or for that matter, we don't have very good information on net migration of workers. So there's a lot of debate about taking students out of statistics. Right now, it's of course not technically possible to do that. The reason being that the ONS, when people leave the country, the ONS asks, why leave? What's the purpose? You know, why are you leaving? Are you leaving for work? Are you leaving for study? The ONS does not ask, what was the purpose of your entry when you came in? So very large numbers of people come in to study but leave to work. So that basically messes up the net migration student figures, but also the net migration work figures. So we can't do it. We will be able to do it at the end of next year. So the best information we have, really, is that on inflows, we know that 60% are students. So that's why most of the policy action that we've seen has focused precisely on workers, family, and students from outside Europe. I'll talk to the policies in a bit, but I should have included one other chart, which is very important, which basically shows non-EU labor migration, non-EU student and family migration. And what's interesting about it, and I think many people don't realize that, is that if you look at non-EU immigration in the LTIN data, so those coming for more than 1 year, these are the statistics that the government is trying to target. If you start in the 90s, it's gone up and gone down again, and current levels of non-EU labor immigration are comparable to what they were in the late 1990s. Okay? So labor immigration from outside Europe right now is comparable to what it was in the 1990s in the LTIM statistics. The same goes for family migration. Family migration increased a little bit, actually it's come down again. So family and labor are under control in the sense that they're at similar levels in the late 1990s. Now, the big change that we've seen is that student immigration from outside Europe has exploded. I mean, that has really, really increased at very drastic rates. To conclude, just a few words about policy. So the first policy change that we saw a couple of years ago with the new government was the cap on skilled labor immigration from outside Europe. The cap has now been frozen for a couple of years at 20,000. Caps undersubscribed. Only half of it has been taken up. There's an interesting question about, you know, why has it been undersubscribed? And there's much greater skill selectivity. Now, one reason why the cap is undersubscribed is that a lot of other policies have changed as well. Most importantly, the skills threshold, the minimum skill threshold, has been ratcheted up. Okay, so that's really increasing the minimum skills requirements are really the policies that have done most of the work in terms of reducing non-EU labor immigration. I mean, put differently, the cap has not stopped anybody from coming in. What has stopped people is that they don't have the minimum skills anymore. Two groups that used to come in substantial numbers under Tier 2 and that basically can't come in anymore are senior social carers, and chefs. Right now, I think if you're a chef, unless you're a very high-end chef and earn, I think, 28,000, something like that, it's very difficult or impossible to come in. So I think the effect really has been on the kind of medium-skilled occupations in terms of the cap, the primary effect. As we saw from Sean's presentation, intercompany transfers have largely escaped most policy changes. Numbers are going up, so that it's interesting. It'll be interesting to see what happens then in the future. Non-EU family immigration, just want to point out, we've had, of course, a recent increase in the threshold. We're waiting to see if that goes to court, because the impacts of the increased earnings threshold that sponsors of non-EU spouses must meet are very differentiated, right? So it's so now the new rule is that you have to earn at least you have to earn around £20,000 to bring people in. If you want to, say, if a British citizen wants to get married or is married to a non-EU person, you want to bring the person in, you have to have at least £20,000. Now, incidentally, for people like me from within the larger EU, that doesn't apply. So I'm in better position than British citizens, which is a slightly odd situation, I think. But anyway, but the impact is highly differentiated. Almost half of British citizens will not be eligible to bring in non-EU spouses under this rule. 60% of women, higher shares of younger people. Of course, particular ethnic groups with particular earnings profiles are going to be affected in a differentiated way as well, so that's important to keep in mind as well. one thing I want to point out with regard to non-EU family immigration is that in some sectors, actually, dependents have made quite important contributions to labor supply. And again, social care is quite an important sector there. That we know from some of the literature on social care that dependents have often found employment in these sectors. So it's interesting, actually, to see how that change affects labor supply in some of these sectors. But a big story, of course, in particular for London as well, where quite a few of the big universities are, is what's going to happen to students. Now, the students, you know, students are the biggest group, so there's no way the government can achieve its target unless it cuts students in a big way. Now, what the government has been doing so far is emphasizing that we must crack down on abuse. Now, of course, nobody knows how much abuse there is. But, I mean, unless there's a lot of information within the Home Office that will one day come to light and show us that the majority of the student route is made up of people who don't come to study but to work, unless that happens, I think it's safe to say that reducing abuse is not going to be enough to get the numbers down sufficiently to reach the target. So that's where the difficulty in the debate, of course, begins, that I think going forward there will be a debate, especially if the net migration numbers don't quite reduce in the way that the government is hoping, that there will be a debate about targeting legitimate students and legal student immigration. And, of course, then you have a debate about further education and how universities are going to be affected. I will say that the evidence based on students, I think, is not particularly strong. There's a wide range of estimates about the contribution of the students make to fees at various universities. Interestingly, students is the one area of policy where the Migration Advisory Committee has so far not been consulted on. I think the MAC has been asked to basically work on all other policy changes, but not students yet. So that would be interesting going forward. Finally, a specific point on London, again stating the obvious. We've had in June a new methodology from ONS to estimate the number of people in local areas. We now have the census results coming out in November and December that will tell us about migrants in different areas, and that obviously will have important implications for processes of resource allocations and councils, especially certain London councils at the moment are obviously looking very hard at some of these figures and what they mean, and they obviously create winners and losers, because inevitably some councils will find that they have lost some migrants through the revised methodology, and some other councils have gained people, and that will have implications in terms of money flows. I'll leave it at that. Thank you.